You're listening to Trucking Questions from the Audio Road with Kevin Rutherford. This is the show that puts the money where it belongs, back in your pocket. You can ask questions about trucks, money, fuel mileage, maintenance, tires, tax, technology, or anything else about the business of trucking. Here we go. Let's head on down the Audio Road.
Welcome to the program. I'm your host, Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. The show is all about the business of trucking. We take your calls. We answer your questions about trucks, money, fuel mileage, maintenance, tires, taxes, technology, getting started in the business, finding freight, working with brokers, you name it. We'll talk about it here on the air. All you have to do is pick up the phone and give me a call. And we're going to get to those calls in just a couple minutes. Last week, I talked a little bit about rates and what was going on and compared this year in March to last year in March and this year in March to this year in February. And after doing that, I also went back and looked at some of the new data that's out right now about what we can expect the rest of the year. Now, before I get to that, I do want to point out that I do this mostly for informational purposes, just so you have an idea of what direction the market might be going. But honestly, I think it's far more important for you to focus on what's going on in your economy. And I made the point last week that if we were in the best market ever, but you're doing the wrong things, you're very likely to fail. On the flip side of that, if we're in the worst market ever and you're doing all the right things, you are very likely to succeed. Some of the biggest fortunes were made during the Depression. Some of the best companies today were started in recessions. So, you know, the media likes to talk a lot about what's going on with rates, what's going on with the economy, what's going on with the market. I don't do it a lot. I do it once in a while, again, to give you an idea of what direction we might be headed in. But if you totally ignored all of this stuff and just focused on what you do every day and focus on improving what you do every day just a little bit, then the market doesn't matter much at all. The economy doesn't matter much at all. Even the government, as intrusive as they get, and as much as I complain about them, honestly, they wouldn't matter much at all. So don't overthink or overfocus on this. And I don't, even though I read it virtually every week, it's just so that I do have an idea of where we are. So if somebody asks me a question and I think I might be able to help them by knowing this information, I can do that. But if I miss this kind of information for a week or a month, I don't miss it. It's just not that important. So having said all that, looking at the spot market and what I think in what other forecasters think might be happening coming the rest of this year. Remember, spot market is the kind of freight that most of you are going after. Spot market is the stuff that makes it to the load boards, makes it to the brokers. Spot market means it's not under contract. We have contract freight and spot market freight, or contract rates and spot market rates. And unless you're going directly to a shipper or contracting long-term with the broker for the same load, then you're going after spot market freight. Spot market freight is very volatile, meaning it can change in a matter of days, depending on what is going on with supply and demand. And contract rate, not so much, because usually the rates are locked in for a long period of time. There are times when contract freight pays better than spot market freight, and then there are those times when spot market freight starts paying better than contract, and that usually happens in peak demand. I don't see anything in the near future that's going to increase demand. It seems like the freight market is really starting to get a little soft. Now, I don't think we're going back to where we were 2 or 3 years ago, but I don't think we're going to see what we saw in 2014 either. I think that for the next month or two, we should be pretty steady, but that's seasonal. I think once we hit June, I think you're going to see a pretty flat summer. So just kind of keep that in mind as you're doing your planning. Don't expect it. And here's one of the reasons you should pay attention to this. I said, if you're doing everything right or most things right, there just aren't that many people doing most things right. There isn't anybody doing everything right, but there just aren't that many people doing most things right. If you were, you wouldn't have to worry about any of this stuff. But if you were struggling a little bit last year during one of the best times I've ever seen for freight, then you need to figure out why you were struggling, because this summer might be enough to just push you over the edge and put you out of business. That is one reason to pay attention to this. If you aren't running a really tight ship, if you don't know your numbers, if you had a couple months where paying all the bills was tough, or if you had a breakdown and had to buy, you know, had to spend less than you should have, if you had to compromise, if you went to get tires and had to buy recaps because that's all you could afford last year, you need to pay attention to this. I don't think we're going to see a really great summer for freight and rates. If you're not down at the bottom, then don't worry about it. It's not going to be a big deal. But if you are, you need to be paying attention. You need to get a handle on your numbers and figure out why. Now, that's certainly something I can help you with here. We're going to get to some phone calls. Let's get started in Nebraska today. Alec, welcome to the program.
Hey, Mr. Rutherford, you had a gentleman that had called in on a previous show maybe a week or so ago asking for ideas on where to find a pre-emissioned long wheelbase truck to go ahead and build up a big super sleeper type of thing. And yeah, the first thought that came to, my head, and I tried to get it at the radio, but apparently you didn't hear me. California is the reason that we are going through all of these emission changes. Well, California has a lot of local trucks that have dump beds on the back, or that have tow truck beds on the back of them. And those have all got the really extended, long wheelbase frame to them. But most of the companies that I know out in that area that go ahead and do that kind of work, they'll rip that bed off and just buy another chassis for it because they don't want to invest $250,000 in a new wrecker bed or $85,000 in a new dump bed and trailer.
That's a very good point.
Just as a general direction type of thing.
Yeah, that's very creative thinking. Thank you for that. One thing, and I don't know this, I don't think that there is, but I was shocked to learn that all of the agricultural trucks you see running around, and in California, you see a lot of single axle day cabs running around moving produce and other stuff. I didn't realize it till not that long ago that they are totally exempt from the CARB rules. I saw some of them
running around. Yeah, because they're traveling less than... It's because of the area that they travel in. And if I'm... There was a big thing. I live in California, and there was a big thing that came out when they were doing it, and they've got these weird programs and whatnot. If you only travel a 100-mile radius, or if you only travel less than 5,000 miles a year or something, you know, kind of... All these goofy little exemptions, and a lot of the ag haulers that you're seeing out there, the guys that are hauling your tomatoes and your grapes and that, they're only seasonal. They're only running 2 or 3 months out of the year. So they've got these really super short wheelbase, you know, little International 9400, or even sometimes they're even doing it with the little 4900s, you know, just something that's got airlines on it. You know, it doesn't have to have a real strong, you know, rear end to it. They just have to be able to plate it for 80,000 pounds. They pull a set of doubles behind it, and basic physics says you're only, whatever you're dragging, you're only going to drag 10% of that weight anyway. So you can get away with a little L8000 or something like that, pulling stuff like that. So, I mean, I don't know, unless I'm going to go through one of those, and I don't want to throw out names here, but unless I'm going to want to go out with one of those independent package carriers and try and pull those lightweight doubles or something like that, I don't think that I would even want to look at, you know, that kind of equipment for anything over the road.
Oh, no, I was going the other way. I was wondering if any of these other local operations had that same exemption and they could hold on to that equipment.
Depends on how far they travel in a calendar year. The last tow company that I worked for, we had one of our trucks, because we only drove it, you know, I think we only put 7,000 miles on it over the course of the last year. Because we were under, I don't know, 9,000 or something goofy, we were allowed to go on ahead and keep that truck. Another one of our trucks, it was a 95 with a 96 motor, and there was some weird exemption just because of a 95 or a 96 or something like that, that we were able to keep that truck. But the other two trucks, we were ripping the beds off of those and going out and buying brand new 2012 chassis, and we were going to drop them on those.
That is a great resource. So really good thinking. Thank you for the heads up on that. And hopefully the guy who was looking will hear this show. Stick around. We'll be right back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. The number to join us, 8888 Road Dog. The website is letstruck.com. When I get back to the phone calls, let's go to Montana. Wally, welcome to the program.
Hey, how's it going today?
Good. What can I help you with?
Well, I got a question and kind of a comment question afterwards. But your first question is, if a person buys a truck, you say, from another person, has no stickers on it, or he has to scrape the stickers off of it, or any decals, whatever they got on it, and they want to move it, what kind of registration do they need, or do they, what kind of temporary plate do they get, and what kind of insurance do they need to put on it?
Okay. So the temporary is pretty simple, and every state is just a little bit different, but temporary is probably the easiest thing to get. I mean, most states seem to be pretty lax about, you know, they'll give you temporary. It's not any big deal. They don't normally, like I've done a lot of work where I buy a vehicle in one state, have to title it in another, register it in a different, and it can sometimes be a real hassle. You've got to get VIN numbers verified by law enforcement and just, but normally with a temporary, they're pretty lax. That's pretty simple. You get a 30-day tag. Some states, even it's a 60-day or a 45. That's usually pretty easy. Go down to License Bureau, or I would call them ahead of time in whatever state you're going to do this in, say, what do I need? I don't think you're going to run into many troubles there. Insurance, at the bare minimum, you need some sort of liability insurance, meaning if you run into somebody or damage somebody's property or body, that you have coverage for that. And again, the amount depends on the state. Every state has a minimum coverage that you have to carry. But that is the one policy that you're absolutely going to have to be legal in any state is liability. If you finance this piece of equipment, more than likely, the finance company is going to require you to have what's called comprehensive insurance on the vehicle before you move it. And that means that if you do any damage to that vehicle, that you have insurance to cover it, because they don't want to be stuck with a total vehicle and you just walk away from the payments. So if you're not financing it, you don't have to put any insurance on the vehicle itself at all if you don't want to. You would then be taking the risk that if you were to get run into by somebody who didn't have insurance, then you're just screwed. Or if you drive it off the lot or from wherever you are and it burns down and you didn't put some sort of comprehensive coverage on it, again, you'd just be out.
Okay. And another question is, I know you're against leases, but and I think I made a right choice for this decision when I went for it. First off, they had a lease opportunity in my company where it's through Quality Companies out in Indiana. And they basically pay the individual that my coworker basically got into it. I kind of decided not to yet. I wanted to watch and see what he does. And he pays $618 a week for the truck, for the lease on it. He's got to pay that for 5 years, plus a balloon payment for $65,000. So, and basically, on the top of it, he's looking at $200,000+ for a $150,000 truck. Every week, he pays $880, includes the people net and the insurance of the company. He's paying, by the end of the year, $43,060. I decided, I don't think I want to go into that as pretty as that truck looks, and I decided to look into becoming a trainer. With that, I basically put a guy on his truck, sit in the right seat, and make $525 a week extra, plus my mileage, and I think I kind of made a good choice instead of going into leasing. I do eventually want to own a truck, but I think I'd rather buy it outright or go to my bank and look at purchasing it there instead of paying that high of a price when I can go borrow $30,000 and use $20,000 to purchase a truck plus another $10,000 to support myself with and operating the dang thing.
Well, yeah, no, I clearly think you made a far better choice. I mean, think about those numbers. And here's the thing that is really scary. I would almost guarantee that his lease is a walk-away lease, right? I mean, if he gets tired of this, he could just
walk away. It's one of those walk-away leases, but, you know, it's 17 days before you make your first payment. I'm thinking, okay, you walk away. I'm sure they're going to want to collect on the first 17 days, so you're going to have to pay that up too.
Forget that. That's not what I'm worried about. If it's a walk-away lease, what that means is he can cancel at any time, but so can the carrier. So what happens if you get $180,000 into this lease and they just cancel it?
Exactly. And then when I looked at all his numbers that he's got into it, I mean, he only puts away 7 cents a mile for maintenance. And I thought, okay, where's your tires at? And he says, oh, I didn't put away for tires. That's part of that tires as well. I was thinking, well, this is a new truck. You got a 2015 Kenworth that's got, you know, it might have a warranty, but it's going to have maintenance done or, you know, put away, even if it's not for your maintenance, but for you sitting around or paying that lease or paying for the weekly lease for it. You know, I'm thinking 7 cents is dirt cheap. And by the time he makes his mileage, he's making 32 cents a mile anyway.
7 cents barely covers preventative maintenance. That's just the usual stuff, oil changes, you know, just preventative. Most of the time we see these new trucks running closer to about 20 cents a mile in maintenance. 7 cents doesn't even come close. It's one third of what he's going to need. And that's if he doesn't have a major breakdown. If he has a major breakdown, it might be covered under warranty, but he's also not working, and that truck payment still has to get made. This is such a lousy deal. I don't like leases at all, but when they get into numbers like this, this is just insane. Now, here's another way to look at yours. Yours was a good choice in so many ways. You could say, okay, what if I didn't train? If I just stayed driving and I make X number of dollars a week, now I'm going to train instead. I make this much more. What if you take all the extra and you save it? Why ever borrow the $30,000? Why not just save it until you have 15 and go buy a $15,000 truck cash and you'd never have a payment?
Well, and here's the funniest thing too. You're going to laugh your butt off on this one. The company I run with, I do a dedicated route going Bellefield, North Dakota to Butte, Montana. I get home every other night, home on the weekends. If this truck breaks down, I get a guaranteed salary of $850 a week. Plus, if I have a student with me, I still get the way a guarantee of having him on as if he's on the truck still. So I also get another $525 a week just having him in my possession, even if he's sitting in a hotel and his tractor's getting worked on. I don't think I'd be wrong just staying as a company driver for a while. I mean, it is a dream of mine to be.
No, there's no question that this was a good decision. And this will give you so many opportunities to become an owner-operator with a 10-time likelier chance of succeeding. That's the whole point. This, your decision virtually takes all the risk out of it. All you have to do now is follow the right steps and you'll be an owner operator, virtually zero risk. He has so much risk, and almost everybody in the lease does. That's my big issue. Let's head off to Virginia. Dave, welcome to the program.
Oh boy, Kevin. I got a question about a lease as well, and it's not starting off so good. I was looking at the Daimler Chrysler and Volvo and a couple of things, and I started seeing this term track lease. And I think I understand how it works. Like the one I'm looking at is I want a brand new truck. I mean, it's just the bottom line. I know how you feel about that. But the deal is on this particular track lease, it's 16.5 down. Okay. Payments.
Let's not start with the numbers yet, because I want to make something really, really clear, because the lease purchase that I bash all the time is an entirely different animal. I mean, other than the word lease, that's the only similarity. Everything about them is different. There's really none of that inherent risk that I talk about, that the company can just say, we're done with you. The company can get bought, they can go out of business. None of that matters. In a track lease, you have legal possession of that vehicle. It's really just considered another form of financing. Now, whether it's the best form of financing for you or not, I'm going to say it's a minor question. We're not talking about, I can't even stress enough how different these two things are. So now let's get to the track lease for a second. And before I even get there, is this your first truck?
Yes, that's why I'm looking, considering a track lease as opposed to just go out and buying them.
Hold on. I want to, before we answer questions that I may not even want to answer, let me qualify a couple of things. How long have you been in the industry?
Since 97.
So you've been around a while, so we've got plenty of time in the industry, but it is your first truck. Tell me a little bit about you financially right now. Do you know what your credit score is?
Yeah, I got a credit score of just a hair under 800.
So you got
plenty of credit. I got about $8,000 in the bank, and when I make this decision, I'll have 17 to work with.
Got it. Okay, that gives me some numbers to go on. I've got to get to a break. We'll come back and we'll talk about this. Stick around. We'll be right back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. I'm going to get back to Virginia. Dave, you still with me?
Yes.
All right. Two more questions. One is, are you going to run California?
Probably, most likely.
Tell me why you would. When you answer probably, maybe, most likely, and here's the reason I ask. Some people have really strong customers in California, and they've got really good paying freight, and they don't want to let their customers down, so they are going to be California compliant. If you're kind of looking around at different operations going, maybe I'll go to California, I would highly encourage you not to.
Okay.
And then you can consider a glider.
I can't can you do track leasing on a glider? So the problem is everyone that I spoke to for financing as a new owner operator, they're looking at $25,000-$30,000 down, even with that credit score.
Well, hold on, Dave, because that was the next thing I was going to get to. Tell me a little bit more about your debt. How much debt do you have in houses, cars, credit cards, any other kind of loans?
Okay, so I have $75,000 on a condo that I still have to pay off, $21,000 on a car, and $4,000 credit card.
Not too horrible. What's the condo worth roughly?
About $115,000, right around there.
All right, I'm going to make, and I know you're going to think I'm insane, but my thought is if you're going to get in business, you should be serious about it. I think you should skip the track lease. I don't like them. I know I said they're nothing like the others. They're not. But you have to wonder why a company would finance you this way, but not the other way.
Well, they will finance me. And then when they start negotiating the down payment downwards, the interest rate goes from, as a first-time owner-operator, had I had the full $25,000, $20,000, like 8%. The number starts working its way up to 12% and 13% the closer you get to
why do you think they want you to have so much down?
Well, to make sure so you have skin in the game.
Do you think they finance a lot of trucks? Do you think they have a lot of experience in this?
Sure.
You're doing it once, they do it 100 times a month. And they've been doing it for years. They know that you are likely to fail with this truck. It's more truck than you can afford, first of all.
Okay.
It just is. I mean, and we have no track record. I don't want you to take this the wrong way. Actually, I don't care if you do. You might be a horrible business person. Have you ever been in business before?
No.
Okay. So, we don't know. I mean, I'm not saying you are. You might be the next Steve Jobs. I don't know. But you might also be a horrible business person. So we have no track record to go on. So to go out and buy a $150,000 piece of equipment with no history scares everybody. So they want to make sure you've got enough money down. I'm going to say if you can't afford $25,000 or $30,000 down, then you're not ready to own a truck like this. So what you're trying to do is try to get around these things by riskier financing. And I just think that's a bad idea. And now throw on top of that risk, what if this turns out to be one of those new trucks that is in the shop 32 times in the next 60 days?
Okay.
You're starting on a shoestring. And one problem with the truck, one major problem could be enough to put you out of business in the first 6 months. And that's why they want all this cash. They want to make sure that if you do go out of business and they know the odds are high, they've got their costs covered. They'll just turn around and sell the truck to somebody else. As long as they got enough cash up front, they don't lose anything. They're not willing to take that risk on you. You shouldn't be willing to take that kind of risk on you either.
Okay, well, so I understand that, but that being said, I'm just curious about the way the financing looks compared to each other.
I'm going to sound like an asshole, but I'm not going to answer your question. I can't give you advice on something I think is really a bad idea for you to do. I'm enabling you is all I'm doing.
Okay, all right. Well, then I've got one other question for you then. This is another concept that I don't understand. This has to do with paying yourself as an owner-operator. As a company driver, I know what I'm putting in the bank per month. So if I needed to pay myself $900 a week, I know that's at like 53 cents a mile. Do I pay myself 53 as an owner-operator, or do I pay myself the actual number that I need in the bank?
See, this is where the business inexperience is coming in. There are a lot of guys out there that I disagree with. Even people who give advice to owner-operators, you might even hear them on the radio, you might see them writing articles that say, when you become an owner-operator, you need to pay yourself X number of cents a mile or X number of dollars a week. Well, that's wonderful on paper. what if it doesn't happen? What if you had to buy a clutch this week? What if you, the truck was in the shop and you didn't make the money? What are you going to do? I mean, okay, when you go to work that. Let me get this concept out, and then I'll get to your more specific question, which is, I think, is more of an accounting question. But the concept, what really trips people up, when you work for somebody else as an employee, the employer takes all the risk. If that truck breaks down and you drove X number of miles, it doesn't matter if they had a $30,000 repair. You still get paid for the work you did. That doesn't happen when you become an owner-operator. When you go into business, you can only get paid if there's money left. And some weeks there might not be any money left. That could go on for a long time. So to put this number out there and say, well, I'm going to pay myself 53 cents a mile or $900 a week, just doesn't work in the real world. And you have to start learning concepts like cash flow. Cash flow means I've got X number of dollars coming in. I have to spend X number of dollars this week to keep the business running. And I also have to set aside X number of dollars because in 6 weeks I've got a tax bill to pay. I have fuel tax. I have IFTA coming up. I have a clutch that's going to need replaced. I have tires that's going to need replaced. So it isn't just a matter of saying I made this much this week and I spent this much this week and I have this much left over. You have to plan a lot for the future. So I am not a believer in all as an owner operator that we pay ourselves until you become incorporated. That's way down the road for you right now. When you become incorporated, the IRS says you have to pay yourself. And then we have to figure out how, you know, what salary should we set and what are we going to do if we don't have the money that week? That's a whole new bag of worms we have to look at. Now, what I do as an owner operator, and if you look at our accounting software, you'll see this. Money comes in and money goes out. And what's left over is profit. Then we have to decide how much of that profit do we need to set aside to cover low cash flow times and bills coming up later, and how much should we take? And that number will literally change every single week.
Well, I was trying to put a cents per mile to figure out the one thing I couldn't find. I don't know if it's on your software, but ATBS is, I paid for 1 month to look at their profit loss statement. And there's no comms, so there's no way for me to figure out how much taxes, how much money to hold for taxes.
That's because they're, and I'm going to give you a number, since now that I know that's the specific question, I'll give you a number. But the reason you don't see one is because it's virtually impossible to put a number that would be accurate for everybody. Because you might have 7 kids. The next person might have 0. You might give $15,000 a year to your church. The next person doesn't give anything. The other guy might have a $500,000 mortgage at 8%. So he's got tons of mortgage interest. He could have really high real estate taxes and you're renting. I mean, our tax code, unfortunately, is 70,000 pages. And everybody's tax situation is different. So it's very difficult to put a number, but I know that it's something people need to know. So over literally decades of doing tax returns for owner operators, I came up with an average, and the average is 9% of gross. Now, because it's an average, it will work really well for a lot of people because that's what an average does. It's right in the middle. But there are going to be some extremes and people are going to look at me and go, my God, you're an idiot. You weren't even close. You're right. I wasn't. It's an average. And if you have some extreme tax situation that I don't know about, then I might not be close. So on the gross, what you're going to do is you look at the settlement statement you get from the carrier that week. And if you earned gross revenue before any expenses are taken out, $3,000, you would multiply 3,000 times 0.09. That's the amount of tax you need to set aside that week. Hopefully that will get you started in the right direction. Stick around. We'll be right back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. Hey, you know, I'm going to go back to Dave in Virginia real quick. Dave, you still there?
Yes.
Hey, I beat up on you pretty bad, and you really took it well, and I like that. I'm going to make you a deal. You ready?
Okay, sure.
I don't know if you've heard me talk about it or not, but I have a program that's designed to help people get into the industry the right way. It's got a workbook, it's got audio, it's got video, you can listen to it while you're driving, you can work on it at night, it's got checklists.
I'm going to buy that.
Well, I'm going to give it to you, but I'm going to ask two things, one of two, and I don't care which one. When you're done with the book, whether you decide to become an owner-operator, some people listen to the program and actually decide not to. After they see the way it should be done and all this stuff, they decide not to. And I don't, either way, if I talk somebody out of this, I'm just as happy as I am if I help somebody do it right. But when you're done with the program, and I don't care if you listen to it 10 times, but when you finally say, okay, I've had enough, I either want you to give it to somebody else who could use the help or send it back to me so I can give it to somebody who could use the help. Is that a deal?
I can do that, Kevin.
All right, I'm going to put you back on hold. Lisa will pick you up. And I really think that you want to do this and you want to do this right. You need more information, and the program is going to give it to you. Let's go to California. Don, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Kevin. How are you today?
Doing great. What can I help you with?
Well, I bought my truck back in September. And basically, if it wasn't for you, I'd be out of business because your program taught me to bank away money for emergencies, and I had a new motor emergency that killed fourth quarter. Yeah.
Well, not good that you had it. Good that you were prepared for it.
Yeah. You know, basically, it was a break-even quarter. I bought the truck. If you don't count what I spent on the truck, I spent close to $40,000 to get a new motor.
Wow. So, hey, you know, I'm in the same boat with you right now. My truck, I'm in Kansas City. My truck is still sitting in Theodore, Alabama, and it's getting a motor transplant as well.
Yeah, well, you know, I bought your program, Stop Holding the Steering Wheel, and I followed 99% of your how to buy a truck. But as you have stated, you can't see metal fatigue or a crack in the oil pump that lets go on the suction side and you spin bearings.
Yep. The best mechanic in the world can't tell us that stuff.
Yeah. So basically, first quarter of this year is done and in the books, and I just want you to kind of look it over and see how it looks, considering, like I said, I don't count fourth quarter of 2014 because it's a wash. It's negative, but that's beside the point.
Got it. Were you the last caller on hold yesterday that I didn't get to?
Yes.
Okay. The reason I ask that is because yesterday we were doing the show in one location. Today we're doing the show in a new location, and the report, the printed report, is back at the old location. We have access to it, though, but what I'm going to do is I'm going to put you back on hold. Lisa's busy giving away the program, and we're going to come back to you, and I promise we'll get to you today. But I need to get the report in front of me, and we will do that, and then I will come right back to you as soon as I have it. You know, I know that sometimes I sound like I'm being really hard on people. And I am, I get that, but I do it for a really good reason. I'm not doing it because I want better ratings. I'm not doing it because I want more people to listen and say, oh, did you hear what he did to that guy? I'm doing it because I want to help people do this right. I've watched so many people fail. Now here's a good example of somebody who did it right and had one of the worst possible things happen. And they were able to survive it. And you might say, well, come on, what are the odds that we're going to buy a truck and the engine's going to blow? They're not that great. They're really not. It's pretty rare. But if it does happen, do you want to be the one that has to say, well, I was an owner operator, but my engine blew up and I didn't have any money? Or do you want to be the one that says, I am an owner operator, or now I'm a fleet owner, or I've been an owner operator for 10 years, but when I got started, I almost didn't make it. You know, I had an engine blow up. I had a carrier that just really didn't work out, but I was prepared. I did enough of the hard work. I did enough of the work up front. And I made it. It wasn't easy, but I made it. That is such a good feeling. In fact, it's never fun when you're going through it, but if you get through things like that, it becomes a way to say, wow, you know what? I did it. And it actually becomes a good thing, and it really helps in so many ways. It helps you run the business better over time. And that really is what I'm trying to get people to see. You know, the caller earlier that I'm going to give the program to, there's nothing horrible about track leases. But there's a reason, and we have to look at the reasons why the finance company is steering him into that program, because it takes away their risk. And it puts even more risk back on him. Well, remember what my philosophy is in business is that we need to minimize risk. Now, look at what the finance company's doing. They know how to run a business. They're successful. They're in business because they understand minimizing risk, and that they're not going to do this deal until they're assured that their risk has been minimized. You need to do the same thing. And that's exactly what I'm trying to help him do. I know he wants a brand new truck, but just because we want something doesn't mean we should get it. Sometimes we just need to take a step back and say, you know what? I do want a new truck, but maybe this isn't the time. Maybe I can do that next time. And maybe I can do it in 3 years or 5 years or 6 months or whatever it happens to be. Because it just might not be the time to do it right now. Let's go to Indiana. Manuel, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kevin. Listened to you for a little while now, about a year, and just had some general questions. I'm having some reservations about starting up, which is what I've been considering for the past 6 months or so. I've been in the industry for about 4 years now. And, before that I was in construction, but I've also been through several accounting classes just in school and also on my own. So I know a good bit of the business side, especially as far as bookkeeping and accounting goes. I'm just considering that my mechanical knowledge is low compared to guys who have been in the industry for a long period of time. And that's my biggest concern right there. I'm considering gear ratios and transmissions right now, and I've been looking for trucks, especially with 13-speed 264 or 79, like you recommend. But I haven't really been able to find much that's CARB compliant. I'm one of those people that have to have a CARB compliant truck because all my family is in California. If I could convince my family to move out of California, I would, but they're not going anywhere.
I get that. Let me help you a little bit. Most of the time when I talk about those two gear ratios, I try to throw in the sentence that finding that setup on the used market is almost impossible. It doesn't exist. Nobody ever really built trucks that way. It's a concept that, you know, many of the things we talk about, we didn't invent, we didn't think of. I saw them somewhere else. I gathered data all the time. But the idea of running what are basically overdrive transmissions with what we consider direct drive gears, that is kind of something we developed. And when I say we, it was a kind of a collaboration between Bruce Mallinson and I. We both talked about it. It seemed to make a lot of sense. We built a couple trucks that way. We converted a couple trucks. We started tracking the results. And it turns out, I don't know why every truck isn't built that way, but they weren't. And they're still not being built that way. So finding them that way on the used market is almost impossible. What you're really going to be looking for is, you know, middle of the road, 13 speed and 355s, 13 speed and 370s, 13 speed and 336 is even okay. We want to stay, right. There are a couple combinations we would want to stay away from. We would want to stay away from a 10 speed with 336s. You know, we could get away with the 10 speed and 355s, but I'd rather see a 10 speed and 370s. The 13 speed gives us more flexibility. You know, I've got to wrap up this show, but I'll tell you what, we're going to get to you on the next show. So stick around. Jonesy's up next. I've got to get out of here. Be safe. Be profitable. Do the hard work and master the journey. I'm Kevin Rutherford.
Success in the trucking industry. This is Trucking Business and Beyond, the show that puts the money where it belongs, back in your pocket.
Welcome to the program. I'm your host, Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. The show, well, it's all about the business of trucking. We take your calls. We answer your questions about trucks, money, fuel mileage, maintenance, tires, taxes, technology, getting started as an owner-operator, finding freight, working with brokers, really anything you want to talk about, I'll give it a shot. I'll do my best to get you an answer. If I can't answer the question, many times somebody else listening will help us out with that. All you have to do is pick up the phone and join us. And I'll tell you what we're going to do. We're going to get right to some phone calls tonight and see how many we can get done in the hour's time we've got together. So I'm going to go to Indiana. Manuel, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Now, I'll let everybody know that you and I were talking at the end of another show, and I didn't even come close to getting to answer your question. So I wanted to bring you back on and make sure we got it answered for you. And in general, you feel like becoming an owner-operator, you've got some business and accounting side down, but you're a little more worried about the mechanical side, the maintenance side. We talked a little bit about some gear ratios. You know, if I had to put in order of importance the skills you need to be successful as an owner-operator, I would put the business and accounting skills number one. I would probably put people skills number two. And I would put mechanical skills number three. And that's not to say it's not important. Though all three of those, in my opinion, are important. But I've seen a lot more people succeed with really good business and people skills, and they know nothing about mechanical. I've seen lots and lots of people fail who know the truck inside and out, every screw, nut, bolt, hose, line, everything, yet they haven't taken any time to develop business and people skills. Keeping the truck running is wonderful, but if you don't know how to keep the business running or deal with people, all you're going to have is a really nice truck and no business. So the other thing that I like is the fact that you're even thinking about this. Most people that go into business don't even bother to assess themselves and say, what are my strengths? What are my weaknesses? Just by doing that puts you way ahead of the pack. So what we know is that if you're going to spend some time learning and getting ready for the business, we probably want to focus more on the mechanical side. Doesn't mean you should ignore the other stuff. I've been in business for 30 years, and I still study business and people skills virtually every week. I don't think there's a week goes by I don't read something or listen to something that can help me in that area. Honestly, if I had to rate my skills, they'd probably be the same as yours. I'm stronger in business, people probably second, and mechanical third. Now, I may be slightly ahead of you in those areas, but the order of them is the same way. I mean, I can't say I've never made a living turning wrenches. I got paid to turn wrenches on helicopters in the Army for 3 years. I've worked in body shops and managed body shops and got paid, but to turn wrenches and fix trucks, I've never been paid to do that. It's never been my job. It's just something that I had a pretty strong mechanical background growing up, racing motorcycles and owning snowmobiles and boats, and then, you know, working on helicopters. But, you know, most of my skill when it comes to truck mechanical issues isn't specific. You know, I can't tell you on this year and this engine, you know, you go in and you tweak this or do that. Mine is more general troubleshooting. You know, I'm pretty good at saying, here's the problem that we're presented with. How do we find the solution in the shortest possible time without spending a lot of money? But most times, I'm going to take the truck to somebody else to turn the wrenches. Doesn't mean I don't do, a good bit of it myself. But you can learn this stuff, and I don't think it's a hindrance to you becoming an owner-operator.
Okay. Do you recommend that I take some sort of introductory class on? I mean, I've actually been looking around for something like that at a community college or something, because I can afford to take the time off.
Yes.
And I really do want to do everything right.
Yep, absolutely. I am a huge believer in education. Even if somebody told me, look, I looked around and the only thing I can find is an auto mechanics class. Well, you know what? If you don't have any real mechanical ability, then go take the automotive class. I would even tell somebody, go take the small engine class and learn how to repair lawnmowers. Mechanical concepts are very, very similar. The size of the equipment just changes. You know, an internal combustion engine on a lawnmower or a chainsaw has a lot of the same concepts and features as an internal combustion engine on anything, a car, a boat, a truck, even though that's a diesel, there's still a lot of similarities. And anything we learn will help us along the way. Now, if you can find a diesel mechanics course, I'd say that's fantastic.
Okay. Yeah. Then I think that's what I'm going to do. In that case, what do you think about, and I've been kicking this around in my head too, about possibly buying a truck cash and just running local for a little while until I'm ready to actually go back on the road, like within 100 air miles, something like that?
Again, I think that is a fantastic idea for a lot of reasons, and let me just give you a few. Being out on the road, over the road, poses more problems than being home locally. One of the things I always talk about, and this is going to be critically important for you, even though I am pretty strong mechanically, I still depend on a lot of people when it comes to maintenance and repairs on the truck. Because even if I can do the work, I don't have time to do the work. So I build strong relationships with people that can help me do that. You are going to have to do that. Doing that when you run all over the country is virtually impossible. I mean, you can't predict when the truck might break and where you're going to be, and you can't build those relationships everywhere. But if you run locally, well, hell yeah, you can go build some really strong relationships and do it fairly quickly. I mean, several months, a year, whatever, and you've got good, strong relationships with shops you can trust. An engine shop, a general repair shop, a tire guy, an electrical guy. And you should focus on that. So that's one big advantage that would help you overcome your weakness on the mechanical side. You can build relationships and use people skills that will help you accomplish that. The other one, and I know this from personal experience, I came,
I went to a 2-week driving school, came right out of driving school, bought a cheap truck for $7,000 and started working locally. It is a much, much better way to learn how to drive a truck than going over the road. You know, you get in a truck over the road, and in the first week, how many docks might you back into? 4 or 5 in a week, maybe. Sometimes not even that, depending on the operation. I had to back into 5 docks in the first 2 hours. And I had to do that every hour of every day. I had to deal with shifting gears over and over and over, downshifting over and over and over, fighting traffic over and over all day long, and backing into crazy little docks all day long. Now, in the beginning, my God, was it stressful. But you learn really quick, and you get that driving down 10 times faster than you're ever going to get it driving over the road.
Right. Last question, I guess. I've been considering Landstar. Well, second to last, sorry. Landstar versus your own authority. And especially in that case, since I am thinking that I'm going to, you know, roll local for a while and just put aside some money for airfare to fly out to California more often.
Yeah, good idea. So let me say this then. If you were saying I'm going to go over the road right away, I would say Landstar, hands down, don't even think about your own authority, because you've got enough to focus on the mechanical side, getting comfortable with that, getting the business up and running. Let's not throw in all that complication of compliance and freight and brokers and all that other stuff yet. But if you go local, then your next step could be your own authority. And you could start planning for it now. And you are going to learn all this other stuff much faster. You're going to learn the driving and the mechanical much faster, being local, building those relationships. And then you could say, okay, my goal is I'm going to get through this, save up this much money, learn this much stuff, and then I'm just going to go right to getting my own authority.
Okay. And last question. I was actually thinking about running both Texas and Louisiana. Which one would be more beneficial tax-wise? I know that I haven't heard you talk much about tangible personal property taxes as it relates to your to your truck.
Texas, hands down. Texas is one of the friendliest business states in the country. So I don't even have to think too much about that one. Stick around. We'll be right back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Right back to the phone calls. We're going to go. I'm going to go back to California. Donnie, you still with me?
Yeah, sure am.
All right. So I'm not sure what happened there. It sounds like you're about 10 feet away from your phone. Let's try that again.
I'm sorry. Is that better?
Oh, that's much better. All right. And now I have the business report in front of me. So let's take a look. We are looking at first quarter of 2015, correct?
Correct.
All right. January through March. Looks like you ran just a shade over 30,000 miles. And you're doing a really nice job on profit gauges. Got a great breakdown on revenue. I can see all the different categories, what's going on there. You're doing $1.51 a mile, all miles. So, are you with Landstar?
Yes.
Okay. That's about, for the first quarter of this year, that's probably only about 10% under average. The first quarter of this year hasn't been nearly as strong as last year. Last year, we were seeing people in the $1.80 range at Landstar. A lot of guys have dropped down into the mid-$1.60s, $1.70. So for your first quarter, in a weaker freight state than we've seen in a while, $1.51 is respectable, no question. The other thing we have to remember is, compared to last year, fuel surcharge is way down. So now the more I look at your number and the more I think about it, and I looked at your fuel surcharge, you're actually doing pretty good revenue-wise. The beauty of Landstar, though, is that it's always something you can work on. You can always work on looking at different lanes, working with different agents. And, a lot of guys that are leased to carriers, they don't have that opportunity. You do. So it's something I want you to always be thinking about and always be looking at your numbers each month. Your fixed costs are relatively high, nothing horrible. 44 cents a mile total on fixed cost. Variable cost, let's look through. You are doing a fantastic job on fuel. So your fuel cost at 32 cents a mile is just outstanding. Now, we had talked about maintenance, and you had mentioned that there was really an engine in there. Where is the engine being accounted for?
Fourth quarter.
Fourth quarter. That happened. Got it. Okay. So, my God, your maintenance cost for first quarter is almost non-existent. I mean, you had a very, very good first quarter when it comes to maintenance. 3 cents a mile.
That's going to change this month.
Yeah, and it should, because if I were to see somebody that had this cost for 6 months, I would be very worried. I would be telling them, we need to look at what you're doing with this truck, because you're not spending enough money to even maintain it. You know, I get that we can go a month or two or three without any real breakdowns, but there's also, we should be doing regular scheduled maintenance, and that cost will add up. 3 cents for a quarter doesn't worry me. I would like to see that average be about six or so by the end of this quarter coming up. So keep an eye on that. Make sure you're not overlooking.
Yeah, it's going to go up because the end of this month I'm converting from 8 to 4 on my drives.
Got it. Okay. Yeah. So, if I see the cost too low, then my thought is he's buying really, really cheap tires. They're not doing their oil changes as often as they should. I mean, even with a bypass filter, you're going to have some cost. So, like I say, it's not a big deal for one quarter. Just be aware that, we've got to spend some money to keep a truck running well. Overall, really, really good first quarter, I think. $1.53 total in revenue for the quarter. 87 cents a mile to run the truck. You got to keep 65 cents. That's a great first quarter.
All right, excellent. Yeah, like I said, end of April, beginning of May, I'm going to convert to wide singles. The drive tires are about worn out. So
good.
It's going to be a hefty expense. I got another oil change coming. So.
Yeah, and here's another place that, when we talk about long-term maintenance cost, we want to control maintenance cost, and that's how we keep them down long-term. If you try to do things too cheap, you can make your numbers look good in the short term, but in the long term, you're going to end up getting killed. And that's what people that don't track their numbers don't ever get to see. You can't figure that stuff out in your head. You've got to be able to see the patterns on the sheet. And one example for me would be, when I mounted those wide singles, they would have counteract beads in them. Now, that's going to up my cost right now, but it's going to make my tires last longer. And it does improve fuel economy, probably not enough that we can measure short term. But again, those are things that all make a difference when we're thinking long term. And that's the way you've got to think in business. So
keep doing what you're doing. You're doing a great job, and your accounting looked excellent. Let's go to Arkansas. Matt, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin, how's it going?
Good. What's on your mind today?
Right now, I'm kind of in the same boat as you are with your truck. I just had to have an in-frame done down there in Savvy, Alabama, and it's been taking about a month because couldn't get the rebuild kit and all that for all the parts.
Is this a 12-7 by chance?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, you know, I know I started talking about this, that I'm a little gun shy about 12-7 Detroits right now. And I want to get to a point, and then I'm going to come back to your question. In a lot of people, not that I care that I get criticized, it happens all the time, but a lot of people said, oh, I can't believe Kevin's just going to abandon the Detroit. He said forever it's the best engine, and just overnight he says we should build Cummins. Well, first of all, it wasn't overnight. I've been talking about this issue for almost 2 years, and I've been looking at alternatives because the problem keeps getting worse. I still love Detroit engines, but we can't run a business if we can't keep the engine running because we can't get parts. That's not something that is in our control right now. In fact, I am sitting here with an engine that needs a bull gear, and there is not a single bull gear in the country that we can find. Now, because I've worked at building such great relationships over the years, I think Bruce Mallinson finally found me a bull gear. The Detroit dealers, we checked everywhere in the country, can't get one. They don't exist right now. And nobody knows when I'm going to be able to get one. So I'm hoping that I get a phone call today and Bruce assures me that he did find me one. So I didn't abandon the Detroit. This decision wasn't made overnight. It's been a long time coming. And the alternative is the Cummins N14 has parts everywhere. So we have to look at, again, it comes back to my philosophy of reducing risk. There's a huge risk that if you have an engine problem and you can't get parts, that's not a good place to be.
Exactly. I mean, it went from, you know, a week job to a month just because we couldn't get the parts. I had to get the parts flown in from Memphis.
Yeah, and you're lucky you could get them. I mean,
exactly.
I would fly them in from anywhere right now if somebody told me I could get them. We need one part. We get this one part over here. We need another part. We've got to look around, and it takes us 2 or 3 days. We find one more part. We've got to ship them all in. I mean, it used to be you needed all these parts. You called up Detroit. They said, yep, we've got them. You ran down to the dealer, and you picked them up. That is not happening right now.
Exactly. It turned out I found a kit, but you talked about earlier on previous show, it had mismatched parts. One was an aftermarket piston from somewhere, and so
yeah.
I told them no way in
right.
Are they going to put that in my truck?
Good choice.
So yeah, but anyway. I hope to be done with it sometime early next week. I don't have an OPS. I want to get one, but right now with in-frame and all that, I'm stretched a little bit money-wise. I can still do oil samples. I plan on doing oil samples. I think you've said the first 5 or 10,000 miles, drop the oil out of it, and change it. Don't even worry about a sample on it.
Let me get to a break. The music's playing. I'll come back and I'll tell you exactly what you need to do when we get this truck back out on the road, and hopefully that's soon. Stick around. We'll be right back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Thank you. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. I'm going to get back to the phone calls. I'm going to go to Arkansas. Matt, you still with me?
Yes, Kevin, I'm here.
All right. So what we're going to do is right at 5,000 miles, drain that oil out, put whatever oil in at that point that you want to run in the truck, whether it's synthetic or whatever brand, because, you know, that's what we want to start using in the truck. I don't care what goes in there the first time. Whatever the shop has doesn't really matter. We don't sample for the same reasons that I don't really care at all for the benchtop instant samples. We get such goofy readings sometimes in that first 5,000 miles that I always end up saying, "Nah, let's just wait till the next sample to see what really happens." So I started saying, why even bother doing that sample?
Since I don't have an OPS, how often do you think I should sample?
We have to determine. And that's something we determine over time. So what I would say is that you drain the oil at 5,000, don't sample. Then when you've got the new oil in, sample at 10,000, but don't change the oil. Just take a sample. And it only takes days to get the sample back. And we look at the sample at 10,000 and then we determine, first off, is there anything weird going on in the engine? Did everything go right on the in frame? And how is the oil looking? And if it looks good, we just keep going. And then we might sample again at 15 without changing the oil. And then we can learn when we should change the oil without the OPS by the condition of the oil. Even when we don't have an OPS, we're not doing long extended drains, we can still use oil analysis to tell us when we should change the oil.
Okay. All right, good deal. I know it's I have one of the ones you don't like, even though it's a 12.7, it's a 2003-79, same as Matt on 9.5 per gallon. I bought the truck for 16 with an APU and all that last year, and ended up putting a 10-speed in it again, a rebuilt 10-speed. I wanted to put a 13 in it, couldn't find it for a good enough price, so I just stuck with the 10, and then I turn around and have to put an in-frame in it, the first quarter of the following year. So
yeah,
it's been a little bit of a rocky road, but I think I'm off to an okay start.
Well, you know, that old saying that whatever doesn't kill us makes us stronger. That applies in business. Whatever doesn't put us out of business makes us stronger. You know what? Even the things that do put us out of business can make us stronger because we're not dead. We get to come back and try again if we want. So, we don't like to see those things happen. But in the long run, they can actually be a blessing in disguise. Let's go to Iowa. Gary, welcome to the program.
Hello.
What's on your mind today?
Performance modifications are something to do with Cummins engines. I have an N14 and an ISX, and really nothing has been done to them, and I don't want to do internal things, if I can help it, high lift cam, that sort of thing. But
yeah,
I've kind of narrowed my search is down to Pittsburgh Power Box or Bully Dog. I wondered if you have an idea either way there. The people I've talked to about specifically my N14 claim something that electronic on the outside is about the only thing I could do because they already flow really good through the exhaust. and have a good turbo. So electronic gadgetry is about the only thing I could do with that, is what I've been told. So do you have a preference?
Well, yeah, there are a couple other options here, but let's clarify a few things. What year is the ISX?
The ISX is an 06 engine. It's an 07 truck.
Okay, so it's an EGR.
Yes, it's an EGR. That's the only thing it's got, yes.
Okay, so just because you mentioned it, stuff like high lift cams, real high performance kind of stuff, I stay away from that stuff anyway. So, you know, internally, there are some things we would do, but we would only do them when we're doing an in-frame. I mean, I don't open up engines to go in and do that kind of stuff. It's just not cost effective at all. Now,
right.
When you talk to somebody and they said the N14 already flows enough exhaust, who was that?
Well, calling somebody about, you know, the Bully Dog specifically, or somebody that has BDI parts, something like that. And they have said that, because I asked about putting on a polished manifold or something, because I put one on my ISX, and they said that it wouldn't really gain me anything other than lower my temperature on the N14, because they have done it, and I've never seen anything improve there other than temperature.
Here's the thing. If we lowered temperature, we changed something, right? I mean, there's a clear indicator. Well, the only way we could have really lowered temperature by polishing that manifold is because we're moving the exhaust through that manifold quicker.
Right.
That's exactly what we want to do. Not every change can be measured on one truck in fuel mileage because there's way too many variables. But if we've tested things over, and this just isn't our testing. I mean, I can show you three different fuel mileage manifolds put out by companies like Kenworth and Cummins, that there's an absolute formula. If you reduce back pressure in the exhaust by X, you will improve fuel economy by Y. I mean, there's a formula to measure. If we know that you port and polish or port and jet hot coat a manifold, we reduce back pressure. We even have an indication temperature went down. So to say, well, the only thing that happens is your temperature goes down is just wrong. That is it.
Right.
The engine working. So I still believe in manifolds. Not to say you have to do one right now, but I wouldn't take them off the list just because somebody said, all it does is lower the temperature. So leave that on the list. Turbo.
Right.
Turbo is always a question that I always run by, you know, Bruce usually, because there's a lot of stuff about turbos I still don't have a total grasp on. We use different turbos in different operations, different engines, different years. So I usually run that kind of stuff by him. A couple other things, though, that engine performance-wise, other than what you mentioned, anytime we let an engine breathe better, it's going to run better. So a fleet air filter is an engine improvement. The fast fuel system delivers a clean, steady fuel pressure. That is an engine improvement. So those are a couple of things that you didn't mention that I would put on your list and consider. Okay, got it. Now I get it. So when it comes to electronics, this is the toughest thing for me to talk about because, and I've said this many times over the last couple of weeks, mechanical stuff, we can look at it and see it. I know if you have a fleet air filter in. I know if you have a fast fuel system on there.
Yep.
I have no idea what is going on inside your ECM. If it's custom programming, I don't know the intricacies of the Bully Dog, what they're doing in there. I mean, it takes literally an engineer who knows how to go in and read all the parameters to know what's going on. I do have a really good understanding of what is going on with the way Pittsburgh Power does things, only because I just work with them. I've been working with them for years. Had I worked with some other company, I would know what they are doing. So it's hard for me to make a direct recommendation for anybody other than Pittsburgh Power. It's not to say that those are other products aren't good. I just don't know that they're doing, or I don't know enough about them to be able to recommend them.
Doesn't mean you shouldn't go do the research if you're comfortable with what they're doing. One of the couple things I will say that I worry about. A lot of people that do programming look for that big, impressive performance hit right off the bat. They want you to get in the truck and see and feel the difference. And many times they take a lot of shortcuts to get there. They start changing timing in ways that they shouldn't. They put more fuel to it than they should. I've seen one of the worst things I see happening is guys who really don't know how to finesse the parameters the right way. So they use a sledgehammer when we need a scalpel. You know, and what they do is they just go in and beat their way in to get things to work the way they want. And many times I've seen them turn off all the safeguards in order to get their programming to work. And I've seen somebody wipe out an engine because of that. I'm going to get to the break. The music's playing. When we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about that. Stick around. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. We're down to the final segment, so I'm going to get right to the phone calls. I'm going to go back to Iowa. Gary, so, you know, when it comes to electronics and things like those kind of products, I'm a firm believer that those are some of the biggest changes we can make to a diesel engine. I mean, it is amazing what we can do with just electronics alone. So I'm a big believer in them. I just want people to be very, very careful what products they're using and who they're letting into their ECM.
Right. And these other things, and you mentioned Bruce, and I've had conversation with Bruce in the past too, and my all of my fast systems and my straight fume uppers that I've got have come from Bruce. I just didn't know, I guess, to be more specific about what I was asking is if you had any direct information, anything where you knew of somebody who actually put one or the other of those units on an N14. So you could know if they made a difference, or somebody, you know, two people, one put one on, one put another one on, that type of thing, to know if they make a difference.
On the N14, I don't. I will tell you in general, the feedback I normally get is that the Bully Dog seems to be more aggressive on the performance side. That's the general feeling that the reporting that I get back. We haven't done any real head-to-head comparisons that I would call good evidence. You know, if I get a call from somebody and they says, hey, I put this on and my God, you wouldn't believe the difference. It runs like, you know, it's the most amazing engine I've ever driven. Well, that's wonderful, but that's not useful information. That's not something I can measure against anything else. If somebody calls me and says, you know, go into fuel gauges because I've got a 90-day average that was this, and then I put on the Bully Dog, and then my 90-day average was this. That's great information, but it's still only one, and we know there's lots of variables. You know, so I don't have enough to really give you I can say I haven't heard anything really bad about the Bully Dog. I haven't heard anything bad enough to say, oh, no, stay away from that. I know lots of people who are very happy with it. Certainly, I know way more with Pittsburgh Power just because we work with them so much. I know how the power box affects engines across the board. And I can't find anything negative about it on any engine that they have it available for. I mean, it's Their programming is pretty consistent. Their concepts are pretty consistent. They go for good, clean horsepower and torque. And if you drive it right, you'll see improved fuel economy.
Yes. Yes, I guess. And I have access to direct information about both of those devices, those electronic devices, one Bully Dog and one Pittsburgh Power, but they're both on cats. So there we can kind of compare it. Both C-15s, and one has one on, the other has the other. But I haven't found anybody that has put either one of those units on an N-14 that can tell me any type of improvement that it made.
Yeah, you know, the one thing I after Pittsburgh Power went through all their EPA issues and they had to go back and certify, you know, the all of their devices on all of the different engines, I don't even know for sure what's available anymore. But what I can tell you is it both of those companies stay pretty consistent. You know, I don't see them programming their device one way for one engine and a totally different way for another engine. Now, every ECM is different, so you have to do things a little different. But I think for the most part, both of those companies are very consistent. They have a concept, an idea, a way they like to do things. And I think what you see happening on the C-15, your direct experience of the comparison, I think you could probably relate that to any engine.
Yeah, okay.
All right.
I was leading the power box route simply because I've done so many other things with Bruce over the years. So that's the direction I was leading. So I just was going to pick your brain is all I was after.
Yeah. Yeah, if we have direct information, it's wonderful. If we don't, we kind of have to use whatever information we have. And again, I think they both companies stay pretty consistent in the way they do things.
Right. Okay. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thanks for the call. Let's see. Let's, you know, I want to talk a little bit about accounting because it's that time of year again. We are getting... Well, I mean, virtually tax season is over. I know a lot of you probably have extensions. If you do have an extension and you haven't filed and you're not sure what you should be doing, we can help. We did get through this tax season. We didn't do a lot of tax returns because I wanted to keep that program pretty well under control. So we opened up tax for a very limited group of people, and we got through the tax season, and I am very happy with the results that we got. And now a lot of the pressure is off. If you filed an extension, then you've got some time. Now, I don't want you to take that as, oh, I have till October, I can just forget about taxes again. If you filed an extension, you bought yourself some time, but you also have to remember, you didn't buy any additional time to pay. A lot of people are misunderstanding the extension. The IRS fully expects that even though you didn't file the tax return, you have to pay the tax. Now, that seems kind of weird. Like, how do I know how much tax to pay if I don't file the return? The IRS doesn't care. They say this is your problem. You had plenty of time. You chose to file an extension. We still want our money. So what happens is any tax that is owed starts accruing interest on April 15th. So the sooner you get on this, the lower your overall interest cost is going to be. And many times people, you know, we dread taxes. We all do. I hate our tax system. It's why I talk about the fair tax as often as I do, even though I'm in the tax business and we make money from doing taxes and we make money on our accounting software. I would lose all of that if I could have a fair tax, because I think it is so much better for the country. I'll find another way to make money. I'm okay with that. I would really like to see a fair tax because our system is a mess. Many times, because it's like that, people put it off. They get down to the end and they say, oh, I'm just going to file an extension. I don't have enough time to get this done. So they file the extension and then they say, oh, boy, I have till October. I can forget about this. I'm not going to do anything this week because, you know, it's kind of crazy. So I'll get to it next week. Or you know what? You know, it's the middle of April. I'll get to it on the 1st of May. And then the 1st of May comes and pretty soon it's October. And now you're scrambling again. If you filed an extension, you've given yourself some time, but get on it right now. Get your accounting in place. And look, if you filed an extension because you didn't have your numbers together, that's because you don't have an accounting system. Now is the time to get one. Don't wait until you get last year's tax return done. By the way, if this pattern sounds familiar, it's because you've been doing this every year. And now is the time to change it. Start your accounting right now, today. Don't wait. Get a plan in place today to get your tax return done. Just because you filed an extension, don't wait. Now, you know that if you listen to this show, you hear about our accounting software all the time. I want you to go try it. That's why we give you a free trial. Try any other software or any other method you want as well. In fact, I'd love you to try them all and see how much better ours is. It's free for 30 days. I don't think it'll take you nearly that long to figure out that this is the best owner-operator accounting software on the planet. So your plan needs to be get your accounting started right now for this year. We will help you do the first month so we can go back and do January for you. We will help you learn how to do the system. That's all part of the startup program that is $50 at the most, which includes your first month of accounting, all of the training, us doing the first month, and the use of the software. You'll have business reports, you'll have tax reports. You've got to get this done. And then get your tax return finished as soon as possible. And it looks like I've talked to myself right to the end of the show here. But this is important. I want you to get this done. I can't pound this into your head enough. Until everybody's doing it, I'm going to keep talking about it. So if you're tired of me talking about it, just go do it. All right. You can find it at the website. It's letstruck.com. You can also call us and we'll walk you right through the whole process so you know exactly what you should be doing. With that, I've got to get out of here. Thanks for joining me. We'll see you back here next time. Be safe, be profitable, do the hard work, and master the journey. Good night, everyone. I'm Kevin Rutherford.
Thanks for tuning in to The Audio Road. If you have any questions, give us a call at 855-800-FUEL. That's 855-800-3835. Check out the website at letstruck.com and find us on facebook.com/letstruck.